Locked On NBA. The biggest stories, the local experts. Every Monday, we dig into the biggest stories in the NBA with the Locked On Podcast Network hosts. Today, for something different, we speak with Miren Fader of Bleacher Report about her in-depth article on LaMelo Ball. We then go to LA to speak with Anthony Irwin of Locked On Lakers about the NBA's best team, and then to Miami to speak to David Ramil of Locked On Heat about Miami at the top of the Eastern Conference. It's all coming up, the biggest stories with the local experts on Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome back to another week of Locked On NBA. I am your Monday host, Josh Lloyd. I'm also the host of the Locked On Fantasy Basketball Podcast, and I'm the lead analyst at BasketballMonster.com and at Yahoo Sports Australia. We have a lot to talk about here. The NBA, we're about a month into the season, so some narratives really starting to develop, some good teams separating themselves, and an interesting feature here on LaMelo Ball. So let's get to it. Now I am joined by a special guest, the author of a great piece that if you haven't read it already, I suggest that you go and do that over on Bleacher Report. Miren Fader is here to talk about her in-depth article on LaMelo Ball, who of course is playing down here in Australia for the Illawarra Hawks. Miren, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first question I've got for you, obviously you came down here to spend time with LaMelo at the beginning of the NBL season. You've also covered him at other times through his career. And you know, part of, I think, some of the negative perceptions that people have on LaMelo is some of the early stuff we saw on him. But how have you seen him change, you know, seeing him down here in a professional environment in Australia versus some of the other stops along the way?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is first is that a lot of people just don't get to see him in practice scenes or working out or, you know, places that there isn't an audience. And I've never seen him talk back. I've never seen him act disrespectful. And it's not so much that he's changed. It's just he's always been like this. And people don't really get to see those glimpses of the more soft-spoken, quiet, coachable side just because they look at his dad and they look at his family and everything that they've gone through publicly and they assume that he's the same. So, you know, he's really not. He's obviously impacted by that, affected by that. But if you actually get to know him, he's pretty mellow, I guess I should say.
Well, that's quite apt. Now, of course, LaMelo's been playing in a professional environment for a while. That stint in Lithuania and down here now in Australia playing for the Hawks, who are struggling. But he is a guy. I saw him in person a few weeks ago in the game against the Southeast Melbourne Phoenix. I thought he looked really impressive. I thought defensively he looked strong. The shooting wasn't quite there, but the playmaking was working well. And to me, he was almost not auditioning for an NBA role because we know he's going to be in the NBA draft. But he was playing in a role that would more be suited to what he's going to do in the NBA versus some of those high school games that we'd seen in the past. Has that been from Mallow's perspective, has that been a deliberate change? Like, I can't be that guy who's just jacking shots up all the time and I've got to really fit into what my role is and get myself ready for it now?
I mean, I think that's just the natural process for somebody that's going from, you know, the high school level to running an offense in an NBA setting with grown men. So, you know, he's aware that he's got a little bit of time to do a lot of things on the court. And that means getting people into the right positions. That means calling plays, setting people up. And I think that, you know, he's always been a natural point guard in the sense he's got great court vision. He's got great instincts. It's just he's never really been in a position where he's had to run an offense that wasn't controlled by people he knows. So I think you're seeing him now just really gravitate towards like, okay, how do I assert myself within a larger framework? And, you know, any 18-year-old prospect sort of goes through the same things and he's learning on the fly. So we're seeing like really exciting things. And we're also seeing things that, okay, like I would love to see him in a year or 2 years, 3 years when he's had more reps at this.
So far in the 10 games he's played in the NBL down here, he is averaging almost 6 assists per game, 7 rebounds, 15 points. The shooting's not quite there, just hitting 24% of his threes. But for those people who haven't seen the NBL, haven't sort of caught onto the league, when you were down here, your impressions of the quality of the league? Because people say, oh, that's fine, he's doing it in Australia, that means nothing, you know, versus what the other players are doing here in college. Like, that level of competition, how do you see it comparing in terms of not only the skill level and the guys he's going up against, but the strength and the size of the opponents, because they are obviously, as you mentioned in the article, you know, players who are, you know, 10 years older than him in plenty of instances, and sometimes 20.
Yeah, I mean, I think the NBL is a solid league. I think it's a strong league. It doesn't compare to EuroLeague. It doesn't compare to the NBA. But I think you have two, like, very, very strong teams in the NBL that, you know, is a good experience for Melo to go against, that being the Sydney Kings and the Perth Wildcats. I think I would consider the NBL a mid-tier league, probably, like, fourth best in the league. And so he's being challenged against, you know, really quick guards. I think the NBL has some fantastic guards. I think the issue is the bigs are slower. So, you know, he can't really get a sense of what pick and roll situations are going to be because the speed is just not the same as it would be in America. But nonetheless, there are worse places to play. I think this is a heck of a lot better than when I saw them in Lithuania. That was just not even a comparison. So I do think the NBL is oversaying how they're developing players. Like, I mean, I watched practice, I watched weightlifting. They're not developing him like they're advertising. You know, it's very hands-on. Melo's development is really his own and Jermaine. So I don't think this is necessarily, like, you know, focused on him and getting better. But I do think naturally just being in a pro environment is good for him.
I think that's important to note. Like, the Next Stars program, I think it's what it's called in the NBL, bringing these guys down, it's not entirely just about these players. Yeah, it's great for the NBL to get the eyes on the league, to get, you know, people like you writing things like this, to get coverage on ESPN. But it's not like we're just, you know, throwing everything towards Melo and everything's being geared towards what he needs to do and what's all about him. It's about winning games in the league for these teams, and he's just a part of that. There's, you know, guys like Aaron Brooks, who was on that team before he tore his Achilles, Australian Olympian David Anderson, who's on that team. These are guys who just go about their business to win games. So it's not like a sideshow. Melo sort of, yeah, there's obviously a lot of stuff that goes, and you detailed so much of that in your piece about the trials and tribulations of him just living his life, but it's not everything is geared towards him when he's down here.
It's definitely not, and I think that it's hard because a lot of the focus is on him, and so his teammates benefit from that attention, right? They're sponsored by Slam. They have these games broadcast on ESPN. He's brought a whole bunch of eyes, but as far as, like, actually developing him as a basketball player, you know, that's a completely different conversation. They're definitely profiting from him and his image, but no, like, practices are, you know, pretty low intensity. Like, he's not like, you know, the prodigal kid that they're just looking to make the best player he can be. So I think that's worthy to note too, and it's kind of a microcosm for what a lot of young kids experience when they go overseas, right? You're kind of on your own. It's not an easy experience. Your fate is kind of in your own hands, and you got to make it work being really far from home.
When you come down and see Melo in this environment and spend this time here, do you think that what you've seen of this experiment with him and RJ Hampton coming down here this season as well, playing for the New Zealand Breakers, do you think that the way that it's gone so far will encourage more of these top prospects to come down and play in this league or play in other international leagues versus going the collegiate route until at least the NCAA or the NBA actually, you know, eliminates the one-and-done rule?
Yeah, I definitely think until the NCAA changes and things change in that regard, this is a prime destination for people. I mean, you have to look at it this way. They speak English there. You're going to make probably six figures if you're a top prospect, and it's not a bad deal. You're by the beach. Like I said, it's not the most competitive in the world, so, you know, you're not getting the competition like in a EuroLeague setting, but, you know, it is very appealing for an American kid to go somewhere where it is very chill environment and people speak English. I think it's, and the weather is nice. I think a lot of prospects see this as an easy transition to, you know, an alternative to, you know, say playing in Lithuania where it's freezing cold. So I think it's really interesting how American prospects are coming up and they're looking more globally than they were maybe 5 years ago. But at the same time, you know, I don't necessarily know if playing on a team like the Illawarra Hawks is going to make you a better basketball player. If you're going to play for Perth or Sydney, I feel like that's a different conversation. But I just don't see the development on these lower tier teams as being comparable.
Well, it was definitely a really interesting read to read your piece over on Bleacher Report about Melo and everything that he is going through down here in Australia. I'm going to try and get to see another game of his later on during the season. Mirren, thank you for jumping on and chatting about your article and about the LaMelo Ball experience so far with us here on Locked On NBA.
Thanks for having me.
Now I'm joined by the host of the Locked On Lakers podcast. Anthony Irwin is here with me. Anthony, we were just talking before I hit record here that the tone of our discussion here is going to be a little bit different than the times that we have spoken in the past, because your Los Angeles Lakers are sitting atop the NBA. They are 14-2. They have won 7 games in a row, and things are looking pretty good.
Yeah, I don't even know what to do with my hands.
You can still tweet out lots of insulting things about players when they make one mistake, but in the scheme of things, you still feel pretty happy about it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. The Lakers have been really good, obviously, in terms of win-loss record. They haven't played the toughest schedule. They've beaten the teams that are in front of them, but even while they have succeeded, obviously, in reaching 14-2, they haven't necessarily reached their peak quite yet. And so I'm kind of interested to see what that looks like if and when we get there.
Yeah, because I was just going to say that to you. So they're sitting atop the NBA. They're 14-2. They've got the 7th best offense, the 2nd best defense in the NBA. Yet there are still things that I look at and go, well, that can be better. And this can get better. And when this happens, you know, things will actually improve. And that's a pretty, I guess, encouraging thought for Lakers fans, a scary thought for the rest of the NBA. They're still looking to get their balance with things going. But let's start with Anthony Davis, of course, the big acquisition. How have you seen his first, 16 games, not that he's played all of them. He did sit one of those games out with that shoulder issue. How have you seen his integration into Lakerland? And where can he improve to take this team to further heights?
It's funny. He's actually kind of played two different seasons. At the beginning of the year, he was not only was he missing jumpers and stuff, but he was reluctant to take a lot of them. And then of late, he's been making three-pointers all of a sudden. And so that's been kind of interesting as a development around his game. But like he's done everything that Lakers fans could hope for, given what they gave up for him. Like, he's made the case for himself. Yeah, that's why you traded not only the young core, but future young cores to come. And he's done so at a rate and helped the Lakers win at a rate that has gotten them to kind of not care about the season that Brandon Ingram is having and not care about the steps forward that Lonzo Ball might take. And I think that's really, when you're talking about early goals this season, that was at the top of the list, and he's checked that off pretty adamantly.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable that the fact that Ingram is absolutely dominating in New Orleans is not even registering really a blip in LA. I guess it helps a little bit that Lonzo and Hart have been injured for the last week or 2 weeks, so they're not having sort of any impact at this point. Davis, speaking of injuries, has had this nagging shoulder problem, and every time he goes up and dunks or blocks a shot, you see him grab that arm, you just get that. Do you get that sinking uh-oh sort of feeling? Because it does appear that we're not, like, that something's going to happen, because he's just constantly grabbing at it. Like, have we heard any sort of official diagnosis of what's actually going on there?
I don't think we're ever going to get an official diagnosis. He is he goes out of his way to make sure that there is no official diagnosis on it, because I don't think he wants to go under the knife. And that dates back to back when he was in New Orleans. That's been kind of his MO on that front. I mean, the other thing too, the maddening thing when you're watching Davis is not only the fact that, like, he'll grab at that shoulder and he'll grab at his side or whatever, but then he'll grab at that side and then the very next play go flying into the stands despite being up 15 points in the third quarter. And you're just like, you know, fans and listeners of my show, I get this comment all the time on Twitter as well, is, hey, could we just, like, get him to not do that crazy stuff when they're up by that much? And that was one of the things, and I think it's going to be a work in progress, but that was one of the things that I was interested to see with LeBron, with him playing alongside LeBron, was would he take in, because LeBron is very good at load managing himself out there on the court in your average NBA game. He doesn't overexert himself if he absolutely doesn't have to. And I'm kind of interested to see over the course of their playing together whether AD starts learning some of those lessons from LeBron as well, because it's an 82-game season. And if it's a random Tuesday night in Memphis, you don't have to dive into the stands when you're up 13. So, yeah, he makes you grab at your heart way too often, but overall the experience is worth it.
There's only three players on this team who are averaging over 10 points per game. There's James and Davis, both averaging over 25. There's Kyle Kuzma, who is somehow averaging 12 points per game, despite seemingly struggling from the outside when watching him play. And then no one else at 10 points or over, which is it's a strange way to construct a roster or to have a team that's as successful as it is. But is it just a case of everybody knowing what their role needs to be and Vogel running through these, you know, seven mediocre to above average shooting guards and playing them in the right spots? Like, how much credit do we give for Vogel for, you know, putting KCP and Danny Green and Avery Bradley and then Rondo and Caruso and Daniels and Cook and all these guys in for the right amount of time in their right areas to succeed?
The Lakers have done a really good job of balancing taking what the defense gives them with also making that a good shot. So the example of taking what the defense gives you and not and having that not be a good shot was earlier this week when the Clippers were playing the Rockets and Harden was double teamed right as he crossed half court, gave the ball up to Russell Westbrook, and the defense basically begged him to shoot it. And he took the shot, missed it by a lot. Patrick Beverley was mocking him from the sideline. And that's one of those situations where if you've ever played basketball, you kind of your teammates would look at you and say, why do you think you're so open? Well, the Lakers do this thing where the players who are that open ask themselves, okay, why am I so open? Is there a better shot to get here? And continue to further attack the defense. And what that's led to is, yeah, like you're saying, the sporadic scoring across the board where on any given night somebody will score their 13 to 15 points that they wouldn't normally score, but it's because that's what the defense was giving the Lakers, and they took it with it also being the kind of shot that the Lakers want to be able to take. KCP has been a bit of a revelation, Twitter jokes aside, and burner jokes aside on Twitter. He's been very good, especially since Avery Bradley went down. It's interesting to see whether or not he maintains the starting spot once Bradley comes back.
Yeah, he has really thrived in that role because before that Bradley injury, there was a time when it looked like he'd almost be out of the rotation. He played like 4 or 5 minutes in one of those games. I thought, okay, here we go. And then Rondo's coming back. That's really going to put the pin in KCP's season. But there, step back up and is really excelling. I think some of the credit not only goes to Vogel but to LeBron in terms of guys just filling their role here and no one trying to do stuff that's outsized for what they could do. Bradley had those criticisms last season for the Clippers, and in Memphis he was taking a ton of shots. You know, Rondo sometimes can overstretch his capabilities at this point in his career. Even Kuzma has dialed the usage down because he is having a particularly rough start to the season, but he is not, you know, going wild on those sort of settings. So is this just a... Is it how much of this is a LeBron factor to really push this team? Like how much more engaged is he this season, do you think, than last year?
Oh, it's night and day. He actually likes his teammates.
Yeah, it's a big difference.
he actually, and look, I mean, I was actually thinking about this the other day that I was trying to figure out why is this Lakers team so much more likable? And I'm 33. I turned 33 in October, and I just think there's a lot more about this team that I can relate to because they're a lot closer to my age group compared to the Lonzo Balls, the Brandon Ingrams, the D'Angelo Russells, the Julius Randles. Like those guys are all in their early to, you know, mid-20s. And with LeBron being, what is he, 35, I think?
Yeah, 35.
With him being 35, I really feel like he relates more to his teammates. And after seeing the way things played out last year, he kind of came into the season completely reinvigorated. And you know, the offense, LeBron James is always going to be a dominating force on offense. But on the defensive end, with how more invested he is with his team, that's where it's really shown up. And it's been fun to watch. Now, I don't think it's necessarily sustainable. I think the Lakers are probably going to go into coasting mode probably fairly. The Lakers schedule gets tougher in December, and I think a lot of stuff is going to come back to earth. But at least for the first 14 games or so, LeBron has been a completely different player from what he was last year, and it's been a lot of fun to watch.
Well, it is going to be fun for Lakers fans for the rest of this season. We all hope that things can stay healthy and keep rolling along for you, Anthony, and all of the Lakers fans out there. And you'll have it all covered for us over on Locked On Lakers. So thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Anytime, man. Have a good one.
Audible has the world's largest selection of audiobooks and audio entertainment. Start listening with a 30-day Audible trial. Choose one audiobook and two Audible originals absolutely free. Visit audible.com/lockedonmba. If you're listening on the go and you can't visit Audible right now, you can find this and all our other offers from Locked On sponsors at lockedonpodcasts.com/offers. Now I'm joined by the host of the Locked On Heat podcast. David Rommel is here with me. The Miami Heat, they sit at a, I guess, relatively surprising 11-4 record, tied for second in the Eastern Conference. David, is it just as simple as saying that Jimmy Butler's here now and that's why the Heat are right up the top?
No, I think that's overstating. That's simplifying it way too much. The reality is that he's helped unlock a lot of what Miami could do, but everybody's kind of understood their role much more completely because of Jimmy. But it also happens to be the fact that they have a number of playmakers across the board, a lot of different players that can score from the perimeter, that can make plays for others, and that's just really unleashed this kind of offense that we didn't expect coming into the season. I knew that they'd have a number of playmakers around the roster, but at the same time, they're shooting so well for the most part. Obviously, they had a bit of a setback against the Philadelphia 76ers, but for the most part, they've been shooting extremely well from the perimeter, in the paint, and they just make plays for others. They're one of the teams that has the highest assist percentage around the league. I think they're second best at this point, although that might have taken a step back after the Sixers game. But either way, it's this combination of great playmaking ability across the board, and they're playing some really good defense, particularly around the perimeter, where they're holding opponents to under 30% from three-point range.
I think what's also understated with what the Heat are doing is that Justice Winslow's been out for the last 9 games with a concussion. We've had Derek Jones Jr. missing a bunch of time. Obviously, the Deion Waiters suspension. James Johnson was suspended to begin the season, and he's out of the rotation. But so much of the success, I said that Jimmy Butler thing at the start as a way to get that oversimplification out of the way, but it's been a lot of these unheralded players who have stepped in. Kendrick Nunn in the starting lineup, Duncan Robinson in the starting lineup, Chris Silva as a member of the rotation. The Heat's tradition of finding these players that others pass over continues pretty much unscathed.
Yeah, they've done a really good job about that. I mean, Nunn's story, you know, obviously he had a pretty good collegiate career. He went undrafted for various reasons, but there was no doubt he could be a high-volume scorer. The problem now is finding other ways for him to make an impact if that shot isn't falling. More often than not, that shot has fallen, but his defense is still a little suspect. He's obviously a little undersized for his position. He can move his feet fairly well on defense, but he's not necessarily a playmaker either because he's trying so hard to look for his shot and being aggressive and trying to knock that down, which is where his strengths obviously lie. But, you know, Duncan Robinson has really been an incredible find for the Heat this season. His perimeter shooting has been fantastic. He had a career high 29 points recently, and he looks like he's a very solid shooter. He's a good cutter off ball also, and he plays solid defense for the most part, and he's got good size at the small forward position.
So with Robinson out there, with Nunn playing that role, it sort of minimized Tyler Hero a little bit. We entered the season in the preseason with Hero putting up really huge numbers and was running a lot of things in games where Jimmy Butler would take a backseat. But Hero's been, I guess, a little bit off lately. But the last couple of games, he's getting more minutes over Nunn. Like, how have you seen his development in this rotation? Where does he fit? Where do all these guys fit when Winslow returns? Because Winslow was playing a ton of minutes at the beginning of the season when Butler was out. And then that fit was a little clunky in those one or two games they play together. Like, how does this all work together? Is there a chance that Winslow's return actually mucks up a little bit of this rotation?
I think so, but against the Sixers, it became apparent that you need somebody who's capable of being another big, versatile defender that can switch on to elite-level players, and Winslow certainly fits the bill for that. He could have done some pretty good work on Tobias Harris or on Ben Simmons, occasionally shifting even onto Joel Embiid, although obviously that's a bad matchup for him. But his defense is such a high level for him that he could obviously make a pretty big contribution in that regard. He's just not going to have the ball in his hands as often because the reality is that Jimmy has emerged as such an incredible playmaker. That's obviously always been an underrated part of his game. But and he's done such a good job of creating plays for others that I'm not sure where Justice fits in automatically. I mean, my assumption is that he'll return to the starting lineup just because he's such a big part of what this team is hoping to accomplish. And if that's the case, I would expect Kendrick Nunn to actually go to the bench and be another complimentary scorer to Goran Dragic and Tyler Hero. Just because I think you can't have too many guys holding on to the ball. And obviously, Jimmy's probably going to play a little bit more off ball once Justice returns to the lineup.
interesting. So if you think Nunn will go to the bench over a Duncan Robinson, who had that electrifying game a couple of games ago where he banged in 9 threes, I believe. Let's talk about a different player here who I think is one of the lead candidates for the Most Improved Player Award. Bam Adebayo has ascended to the starting center role, which he took over from Hassan Whiteside last season. But it really is a different story this year because we're not seeing those 27-21 minute splits with Adebayo and Whiteside. He is the starting center. And one thing that has really emerged from Bam this season is his playmaking. You talk about Jimmy Butler as a playmaking. The Heat are getting playmaking from non-traditional type positions. But how important and how good has Bam been really on both ends of the court?
Well, defensively, we already knew he could play at a pretty high level. His versatility is probably among the top 10 players in the league on defense. His ability to guard bigs against Joel Embiid, he was actually able to harass him fairly well and keep him from getting comfortable position on offense. He spreads his feet widely, gets a good base, and he's strong enough to really hold his own against even the bigger players like Embiid. But he's also so quick that he can guard ball handlers. He's done a great job in the past on guys like Giannis Antetokounmpo, Steph Curry, you name it. I mean, there's a number of players around the league that know how well he can play defense. So I'm not surprised at his defense this year, although I think he's taken it to another level. But in offense, he's certainly being unlocked in a certain way so that he can create plays for others. They position him in the high post, and he's able to kind of see how the offense is playing out. He knows who's cutting and when. He's very good. He's talked to me about the kind of film study he's done during the season just to understand everybody's tendencies, not only opponents, but his own teammates as well. So he understands where they want the ball, how they're going to be positioned, and that's really helped him to unlock that additional level of his playmaking ability.
You've referenced it a couple of times, but the last game that the Heat played was a pretty devastating loss against the Sixers, 27 points down. They had won 5 in a row prior to that. It was the second game of a back-to-back. So I guess the question to you, David, to round this out, is that a sign of some worrying things that might need to be fixed against the better teams in the league? Or is it just one of those games where everything went wrong off that large win streak on the road on a back-to-back against a really good team?
Well, the energy level was so disparate between the Heat and the 76ers. Obviously, Philadelphia trying to prove something with the return of Jimmy Butler after having played one season there last year. And they were obviously keyed in on trying to make a point and make a statement against Miami. I don't think Miami understood the intensity. And we saw guys like Nunn and Robinson kind of exposed a little bit, particularly in the first quarter when they had these kind of jitters because they weren't prepared for the playoff-like intensity of this kind of matchup. And Philadelphia, you have to give them credit. They obviously played defense at a very high level. They understood what Bam was doing on offense, and Joel Embiid played off him significantly. And so he wasn't able to find the same kind of seams in the offense where he was able to find guys cutting. And the Sixers did such a good job of limiting guys on the perimeter, staying with them, closing out well. And so you minimize this component of Miami's offense, which has been the off-ball movement, the constant cutting. And so all of a sudden the offense became really stagnant. And, Miami just couldn't find a way to score with any kind of ease whatsoever. So as far as any kind of trend for Miami, I'd say it's more indicative of the fact that they need to find some different kind of playmaking ability, something outside of the norm there, and maybe even be a little bit more aggressive on offense with guys looking for their shot. Jimmy Butler in particular has kind of taken a step back as a scorer because he's trying so hard to be a playmaker and get other guys going. But unfortunately, against the Sixers, he kind of needed to be a little bit more aggressive, and he really wasn't. He missed a number of his shots there, and that kind of exposed the limitations of this team. So they do a good job of beating up the bad-to-average teams, but against elite-level teams, particularly ones as good and as energized and engaged as the Sixers were on Saturday night, they were pretty much exposed for being maybe a mid-level team and not necessarily an Eastern Conference contender.
They get things back in action against the Hornets on Monday and then a big matchup against the Rockets on the road on Wednesday. David, you'll have all of that and the rest of the season's info covered for us over on Locked On Heat. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Absolutely.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Locked On NBA. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter at @RedRock_Bball and to follow this podcast on your favorite podcast provider, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and go and give us a 5-star rating and review. That would be awesome if you could do that. Guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.